This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. You may not know of the word acedia. Kathleen Norris tells us that references to the word were frequent in the 14th century, then disappeared until 1891. By 1933, the Oxford English Dictionary declared the word obsolete, but after the genocidal horrors of two world wars, the word is back in use. Norris says the word's significance stands in inverse proportion to its obscurity. Today, Kathleen Norris, author of the highly acclaimed spiritual memoirs The Cloister Walk and Amazing Grace, is live in our studio to talk about her new book, Acedia and Me, A Marriage, Monks, and a Writer's Life. And what is acedia? You'll find it in the newer dictionaries. Wordnik says, this ancient word, which in Greek simply means the absence or lack of care, has proved anything but simple when it comes to finding adequate expression in English. We'll talk about acedia, what Norris calls the vile temptation, in 5 minutes following news. This is Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese, and it's Talk of Iowa for this Monday. Kathleen Norris writes, at its Greek root, the word acedia means the absence of care. The person afflicted by acedia refuses to care or is incapable of doing so. When life becomes too challenging and engagement with others too demanding, acedia offers a kind of spiritual morphine. You know, the pain is there, yet you can't rouse yourself to give a damn. Kathleen Norris, it's really great to have you today on the program. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
When did you first hear of the word acedia?
I was in my 30s, and I was had been hanging out in monasteries and monastery libraries. It was a new interest in my life when I was out in Western Dakotas. And I often tell people, when you're living that far isolated, in those isolated circumstances, you go to monasteries for excitement. And that's kind of what we did. I made all sorts of new friends, had new libraries and new sorts of reading to encounter. But what happened was, really, it's something that happens to readers a lot, and it's one of the reasons I think we keep reading books, is when you find an author who has described something you've experienced but you've never had a name for. And in my case, it was a writer who had been writing 16 centuries before, in the 4th century, described back to me an experience I'd had when I was 15 and had always wondered about but never quite knew what it was. And there, his description of it, a man named Evagrius, writing this book about the human nature, really, in the 4th century, had nailed it. He called it acedia, and described what happens, that, you know, when you have it. And I was just stunned. And I knew right then, I was actually working on my first book, Dakota, when this happened. And I knew right then that this was a book I wanted to write. It took me a long time, almost 20 years, to collect all the material and finally do it. And I wrote other books in the interim. But this book has always been at the back of my mind.
All right. So this is what you might call a rare word. As I mentioned in the open to the program, the word, you say the word has a peculiar history. It has gone in and out of favor for years. The Oxford English Dictionary included it in 1933. It peaked in about the 14th century, and now it's showing up even in online dictionaries. As I mentioned, a couple of online dictionaries list it, very brief definitions. But, you know, it's funny because when you look at the title, it's kind of a nice, it sounds good. The word kind of flows, acedia.
Nice, soft
sound.
Yeah,
it sounds like it's a pleasant thing.
Not exactly. It's probably the most, that was one of the reasons it took me so long to write the book, because it's hard to write about something so negative. But the word is, I think we do need the word, and the main reason we don't know it is, unless you were a student of monastic studies or medieval literature, you probably don't encounter it on a regular basis. And I think it first appeared in the 4th century in these early monks sort of looking at human psychology and figuring out what are the worst things, that the worst thoughts that tempt us. And I'm so grateful to them. They never use the word sin. They use bad thoughts, which we all can relate to. And to them, the worst of the bad thoughts that plague us were pride, anger, and acedia. And acedia was actually in some ways the worst, because it could lead to a total abandonment of one's faith, one's trust in God, one's monastic vocation, and in life itself. And so, you know, they really understood how bad it was. And then a couple centuries later, when the church was developing the dogma of the seven deadly sins, acedia kind of got stuck into the sin of sloth, which came to mean a more physical laziness or maybe laxness, you know, being lax about your religious duties, like going to church. But that terrible spiritual import that the early monks had discerned was kind of lost. And I think we need it. I think acedia is a real condition that most people experience at some time or another, just like we do anger, pride, greed, gluttony. And so I think it's a very useful word.
So it got kicked out of the seven deadly sins. It almost made it, but not quite.
Well, it's in there, but it's tucked into the sin of sloth. So only there were eight bad thoughts and only seven deadly sins.
How does acedia differ from depression?
In many ways. And one of the ways I knew that it did was because every monastic person goes through acedia, because it's like the marathon runners are going to hit the wall at some point, and that'd be a metaphor for it. But I think, you know, once the romantic image of the monastic life fades away, you think, oh, this is a wonderful community, this is where I belong. You know, people enter a monastery with all sorts of ideals. And when the reality of the life kicks in, you're with the same people all the time. You're doing the same things at the same time every single day. You know, it can get very monotonous. And acedia will, you know, prompt these thoughts, bad thoughts about, like, well, why are you here? This is meaningless. And one abbot said it usually manifests as some young monk coming to him saying, I'm a fraud, you're a fraud, I've got to get out of here. I can't imagine spending the rest of my life doing this. And, of course, the answer is you don't have to worry about the rest of your life. You worry about today right then. So for a long time, people thought that only monastic people would really suffer from it because their lives are so routine.
Well, routine. You mentioned that having routines is actually one way to fight acedia. You know, do the basic things you have to do each day. But you've been plagued by it from time to time yourself, haven't you?
Oh yeah, and I think when you ask about the difference between acedia and depression, one thing that I realized was that I knew that every monastic person goes through acedia, but not all of them suffer from clinical depression. And these days, the ones that do have depression go to a doctor, and some of them take psychotropic drugs, some of them use other therapies. I knew there was some distinction. And for myself in my own life, I would generally say I have what I think psychiatrists call situational depression. If I'm depressed, I generally know why. After my husband died, of course I was depressed. I mean, that's a period you have to go through, a period of grieving and being sad. Someone loses a job, you know. I mean, all sorts of things can happen that make us depressed, and that's a normal response. With acedia, for me anyway, it just can pop out of nowhere. I can be feeling fine. I wake up in the morning thinking, oh, yeah, I'm looking forward to doing that today. No, you're not. You know, just forget about it. It's meaningless. It does, you know, it. And now that I know what it is, I have some ways of recognizing it and dealing with it. A metaphor I use in the book is Rumpelstiltskin. You know, if you don't know the name of what is plaguing you, you're at a big disadvantage. But once you have the name, you can deal with it better.
Called the noonday demon. Who invented that phrase to describe it?
That's a line from Psalm 91 that the monks, a lot of these early monks memorized the Psalms. Books were very rare and expensive, so they memorized the Psalms, and it's the plague that strikes at noon. And actually, that's in Psalm 91, and they took that as a metaphor sort of for what they would experience, because here they were living in the desert, kind of off the grid, sustenance farming and living. And in the early morning, you know, it was cool and things looked fine. They could say morning prayers. But by the time they were hungry at noon and the sun's beating down, it was very easy to become lethargic and say, hey, you know, what am I doing here? Why should this matter? Does this have any meaning? And the ironic thing for me was that my experience, when I had this classic experience of acedia, it was at my lunchtime job. I went to a private high school, had a scholarship job, and it happened right at noon, which I think is pretty funny.
Okay, you were in high school, and you had your first bout with acedia.
Yeah, and it was basically, when I discovered this description that had been written in the 4th century, it just knocked me out because it was so completely what I had experienced. It happened at noon. And I was a receptionist at a music building on the campus. And it was a job I loved, but all of a sudden it was like a bad thought just kind of occurred to me that, you know, one more thought followed. The whole cascade of thoughts following on one another, each one bringing me more and more down. And, of course, you know, I was 15, and all of a sudden life just was looming large and long. I mean, how was I going to spend the rest of my life? And, I was still very dependent on my parents. I had a lovely family, and I thought, well, they're not always going to be there. And how am I going to live every day? And do all these things. And of course, you know, it was this cascade of thoughts almost assaulting me. And that is literally how the early monks described it too.
A cascade of thoughts. Well, you would talk about depression being situational, but then your high school experience was not all that great, and you had some pressures on you. You didn't fit in very well, right?
No, and that's the typical, you know. So I think you tap the shoulder of a lot of artists and dancers and actors and saying, were you a real hit in high school? Were you one of the popular kids? And they'll say no. I mean, it was pretty normal that way, except for occasionally these odd experiences where I didn't have any way to talk about it, even with my friends, these odd sort of cascades of thoughts. And one of the things I discovered in my research, because I did a lot of research on depression, I had a psychiatrist as one of my readers for the manuscript, you know, because to catch really any really stupid things I would say. But I discovered that one of the methods that the Evagrius recommends, this monk, 4th century monk, says that one of the things you can do is when you're experiencing bad thoughts, you think about your thoughts. You observe them dispassionately as they arise, and there's no guilt involved, no blame, because the thoughts come to everyone. I mean, everyone's going to get angry at some point. Everyone's going to feel envy, acedia, whatever. You examine the thoughts as they arise, and that gives you a little bit of control. You can sort of decide how you're going to respond to them. His method is remarkably similar to some of the new techniques in behavioral therapy, thinking about your thoughts. That's one of the ways that modern therapists are using.
It sounds a little bit like Zen Buddhism too, doesn't it?
Yeah, and mindfulness would be probably the word they used. And when I was working on this book, I was at a conference of Benedictine and Buddhist monks, and which is actually pretty common. The Benedictines and the Christian monks and Buddhist monks have been getting together for about 50 years and having conferences and talks and doing books together and things. And I went up to two Zen Buddhist monks, two young Americans, and I described acedia to them. And I said, as monastic people, I think you know what this is, but I don't know what you call it. But I'm sure you experience it because of, you know, your life. And one of the monks, the man said, we would probably call it torpor, which is one of the five hindrances to prayer, which would make sense. I mean, the early Christian monks experienced it as a hindrance to prayer as well. And the young woman said, our community was founded by an Anglican, and we just call it acedia, which I thought was great.
Well, we need to take a minute break. Kathleen Norris, author of Acedia and Me, and author of the acclaimed books The Cloister Walk and Amazing Grace. We'll be back in a minute. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. And Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese with Kathleen Norris, author of The Cloister Walk and Amazing Grace, her new book, Acedia and Me, A Marriage, Monks, and a Writer's Life. We're live this hour, so if you have questions for Kathleen Norris, and I should mention you're speaking tonight at the Iowa City Public Library. That starts at 7 o'clock in Iowa City. Our toll-free line is 866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Again, 1-866-780-9100. Kathleen, this is just a terrific book. It's very moving, and you have so many interesting sections I'd love to read aloud, but I'm not going to do that. I thought I would, as we go through the hour, I would just read little bits and pieces to continue our conversation. For example, chapter one, quoting your book, having experienced both conditions, the other condition being depression, I think it likely that much of the restless boredom, frantic escapism, commitment phobia, and enervating despair that plagues us today is the ancient demon of acedia in modern dress. It's been around for a long time then.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's human. It's part of our human makeup, I think. And thank you for reading that. Because that, when I realized that, was one of the motives for writing the book, because I realized acedia isn't just an individual spiritual problem. It really affects communities. It affects society at large. And when you look around, I mean, you know, frantic escapism, commitment phobia, and enervating despair, that is really descriptive of much of American culture. And acedia is very interesting in that it manifests itself in two very different ways. It can make you feel like doing nothing, having both restlessness and boredom at the same time. And it's that condition where you're lying on the couch and you think, well, I should take a walk. No, I don't want to do that. Or I could do this, or I could do that. And you shoot everything down and you end up in this incredible state of lethargy. On the other hand, if you're seeking to not care, one of the great ways you can do that is to become hyperactive, become a workaholic, and get so busy that you know longer can care. You know, you've lost your sense of really caring. So it can manifest itself in so many different ways. It's a very tricky little devil.
Now, there's one quotation. It's ahead a few pages, and I haven't found it yet, but you imply that if you care too much about your job, that can be acedia.
Well, it can be, because if it distorts your being able to care about anything else. And, you know, when Evagrius was writing and delineating kind of the eight bad thoughts, he also wrote about the eight good thoughts, or the virtues that help us out. And the opposite of acedia is zeal and ultimately love, because that is the ultimate form of caring. And so often we're reluctant to really commit and to really do all the things that love requires of us. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to write about my marriage in the book, too, because I think, you know, I never expected to be married. I didn't settle too easily into it. And I think ultimately learning how to care and how to really love is a major theme of my struggle with acedia. So that's why I write so much about my marriage.
And your husband was the late poet David Dwyer. And he also had his periods of acedia.
Well, he really suffered from classic depression. And the psychological method, psychotropic drugs, working with psychiatrists all his life, that really worked well for him. And even as a teenager, I sensed that it wouldn't work for me. When I had that experience at 15 and later in college, a few more of them, it didn't seem like classic. I'd taken some psychology courses. It didn't seem like classic depression. It didn't seem like something that would make sense to a psychiatrist or psychologist. And so I was, not until I discovered sort of the monastic tradition and spiritual direction, was I able to get some help. So, my husband was like a classic depressive, and I was a classic acediac, and the marriage worked for 25 years. So kind of a comedy of errors often, but that's who we were and what we did.
And you were both poets, writers, living in, for most of that time, in a very isolated part of northwest South Dakota, Lemon, a small town in your grandmother's house.
Yeah, the house my mom grew up in, yeah.
Right. Let's go to the phone and talk to Tim, who's calling from Iowa City. Hello, Tim. Whoops, I need to press the button. That would help. There we go. Tim, are you there?
Yeah.
Go ahead with your question.
Oh, all right. I just wanted to say, hey, this interview is going really great, and I was feeling like what you guys are talking about. And I just didn't know the word for it. And also, like, I didn't know how I felt. And then I found it through reading Hermann Hesse's Steppenwolf. And I just wanted to say it's a real interesting topic you guys are talking about. And I'd like to say thanks.
Oh, thank you. And actually, you know, one of the things I did, because I collected material on this for so many years, the last section of my book is, I call, a commonplace book of quotes. I don't know if I have Hesse in there, but he's part of a literary tradition kind of writing about this condition. And I thought that would be useful for people. I mean, I start with the psalm and I end with a 21st century college student, but in there I've got Dante, I've got Baudelaire, I've got a lot of the 18th, 19th, 20th century existentialists. I can't remember now if I actually did quote Hesse, but I think there was a lot of interest in this condition, and they called it different things. Some people did call it acedia. Some called it ennui, mal de siècle, the illness of the age. And it was fun. When I did my research, someone said in the 18th century, people began to fear ennui just as we fear cholesterol today. And there's a lot of literature on this.
Tim, anything else?
No, I just like to say thanks, and I'm going to have to check this book out.
Okay, thanks a lot for
Thank
the
you.
Call.
Yep, bye.
866-780-9100. Let's go next to Liz in Iowa City. Good morning, Liz.
Hi. Morning. Well, a few years ago, I was diagnosed with severe anxiety disorder that leads into depression, and I'm just wondering, it sounds like the exact same thing, and wouldn't the psychiatric community just call that severe anxiety? Because I ended up being, I think, the best treatment for it was cognitive behavioral therapy and just retraining your those cascade of thoughts and thinking about your core beliefs. And so I'm just wondering what really is the difference and if it could be confusing calling using all these different terms.
Well, this is a word that's been around for about 1,700 years. So, I mean, that was one of the things that I thought it was useful to remind people that people had been looking at these conditions for all that time and had a word for it that worked pretty well. One of our problems with the word depression today is that it means everything from mild disappointment to really severe clinical depression or anxiety disorders. And I think if you're in behavioral therapy, you're actually using some of the same methods that Evagrius talked about in the 4th century. That was one of the great discoveries I made when thinking about your thoughts, looking at them and sort of meditating on them. That's part of his book, The Practicos. He recommends doing that. So I think it's kind of like we've come full circle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would really encourage anyone that has this to really check into cognitive behavioral therapy because it really changed my life.
Great. I'm glad it worked.
Thank you very much, Liz. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for that great call. 866-780-9100, Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. This section in the book goes on for many pages. You call it a commonplace book. Fascinating quotations from writers, scholars, philosophers. Chaucer says in The Parson's Tale, he says, "Acedia wastes and it allows things to spoil." So this is indeed an ancient, well, not ancient, Chaucer was the Middle Ages, but it does go back, 1,700 years, right?
Yeah, and I found, you know, one of my great joys, I found a quote in a James Bond novel. Of course, Ian Fleming had a classic British education, so he knew the word. And from Russia with Love, just as at least in one religion, acidity is the first of the cardinal sins, so boredom, and particularly the incredible circumstance of waking up bored, was the only vice Bond utterly condemned. That was a good day when I found that quote.
Before we take another break, here's this quotation, Kathleen, about your high school cafeteria experience in Honolulu. The bracing thought of adulthood as opportunity, as terra incognita that I might be glad to explore, was swept away by a burgeoning sense of helplessness, self-pity, and terror. The present moment had become unbearable, and I could conceive of the future only as more of the same, an appalling, interminable progression of empty days to fill. Sounds like high school to me.
Right.
Well, it worked out okay for you. You did better at college,
eventually.
Right?
Yeah, because I went to Bennington College, which really emphasized the arts. And I think, you know, a lot of the people at Bennington felt at home for the first time when they were there because they'd never felt at home in their high schools.
We'll take a break for about 5 minutes, and we'll get back to our conversation at that time with Kathleen Norris, author of Acedia and Me, A Marriage, Monks, and a Writer's Life, as Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. Ten:36 Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese with Kathleen Norris. Her new book is Acedia and Me, A Marriage, Monks, and a Writer's Life. And we definitely learn a new word when reading this book, the definition of acedia. And Kathleen, I may ask you to, did you want to read one more excerpt from one of your writers that you are talking about what acedia is?
Well, this is Czesław Miłosz, the Polish-American writer. It's an essay that from the Garden of Knowledge, and it was one of the things I found that convinced me, yes, there was a political and social dimension to this. And of course, he's someone who was in Europe during World War II, survived a lot of terrible things. He says, "No one can call this failing simply laziness any longer. Whatever it may once have been, nowadays it has returned to its original meaning, terror in the face of emptiness, apathy, depression. It's not isolated hermits, however, who are experiencing its sting, but the masses in their millions." And, you know, I began to see that Acedia was around us in our culture, and that the 24-hour news channels like CNN, Fox News, MSNBC were really contributing to it in a funny way, because one day I was noticing the screen went from child sex offender search to gas prices rise. And just visually looking at it, each of those items had the same importance, the same value. And being bombarded with all of this stuff all the time, how can we decide what is worth caring about? You know, so our whole culture, the media culture, struck me as a perfect vehicle for acedia.
Acedia meaning, ultimately, I suppose, you just don't give a damn about much of anything, right?
Yeah, or you become an extremist on one thing. Mm. One thing obsesses you, and you care about that. But that's not real caring. It because you're basically ignoring everything else in your life. It, you know, you that would be one form of acedia, like that restlessness and the needing a cause, but finding a very false one. Whereas caring about the things that you should care about, caring about the important things, the things that have value, that takes work.
Let's go next to Bill, who is calling from Cedar Falls. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This sounds like a good opportunity to get into one of the things that struck me very positively about your book. I'm somebody who's also dealt with acedia in my life, and really the way out for me has been through engaging in lay monastic discipline and engaging these very issues. And you pose in your book a contrast between what you call industrial acedia, and on page 124 you talk about the confused heart, having lost joy within itself, seeks consolation outside. The more it seeks exterior goods, the more it lacks interior joy to which it can return. And then following that, you talk about the importance of conversatio morum, you know, the change of one's heart. And one of the things that struck me there was your statement that I can imagine a life without psychotherapy, but not without conversatio, for it promises to help me distinguish between fruitful self-knowledge and sterile self-consciousness. And I just wondered if you'd like to expand more on, you know, really the spiritual aspects of this and how you know, the teachings of the desert monastics are re-engaging or being re-engaged here in our modern times, and Martin and others. But you know, the importance of the spiritual and how the desert monastics believe that you know, the Bible and spiritual texts had healing power in and of themselves.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, a lot of people would have trouble experiencing that today, you know, without immersing themselves a lot in the Psalms and that tradition. But I think that the wisdom of the desert mothers and fathers is fairly universal. I mean, I really think of them sometimes as our first psychologists, in at least in the Western tradition, understanding human nature so well and reminding us, yeah, that if you're totally distracted by externals and seeking goods and money and power, your inner life will suffer, and they have all sorts of ways to deal with that. And their psychology is really, really subtle. One of the best things for me that they do is they talk about, you know, examining your thoughts. Say you want to stay by yourself in your cell or your little room, and you're going to try to meditate, but you're really doing that because you detest other people, you're looking down on them, you think they don't appreciate you, you're holding grudges. then the remedy is to go out and join with the community, do whatever those annoying people are doing as a group in a monastery. Of course, it would be going to prayers and meals and recreation together, but like in a church community or a job or something. No, you go out and you accept the other people as gifts to you, and you learn to work with them. You're not going to stay in your cell nursing grudges. On the other hand, if you're in your cell and you should be praying or meditating or working on your inner life, and you're tempted to go out because you think, oh, well, there's so-and-so is sick, I should go visit them, so-and-so I should see, so-and-so I should do all these things, then you have to examine your thoughts to see, am I really just trying to go out with other people in order to use them as distraction? And that's one of the ways they actually define lust, as seeking other people for inappropriate purposes. Would mean even visiting the sick could be that if your motive was really to avoid the inner work that you needed to do. So they have this wonderful psychology of examining your thoughts and trying to figure out what your motives are and then act appropriately.
And I would add to that, you know, the importance of showing up and doing, you know, manual labor was an important thing for the desert monastics too.
Yeah, manual labor and prayer were linked because they would recite the Psalms from memory as they worked. And in fact, that was when I interviewed one abbot who's, you know, when I said, what do you do when somebody comes to you, you know, and with all these, and they're really struggling with acedia? And he said, well, I try to decide if it really is just good old-fashioned acedia or if it's clinical depression, and then I would send him to a doctor. But if it's just what we all experience as monks, he said, sometimes I'll say, why don't you do something different? Go out and here's a garden plot. You work it. Some kind of physical labor, physical exercise. You know, something. He said anything to get them out of that, break out of that closed circle of the self, which is really where all the bad thoughts will lead us. There doesn't seem to be a way out, but it's mainly because we're just too self-absorbed.
Bill, thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Bill from Cedar Falls. He called 866-780-9100. He grabbed my next question. I was going to quote from Evagrius, the 4th century monk that you love so much, talking about the benefits of manual labor as a way to fight acedia. Sometimes just get off the couch and do something.
And therapists, you know, psychologists will tell you that too, that often it is that going out for a walk, getting some exercise is a way that jogs both your body and your soul. You know, there are benefits to physical labor and to physical exercise. There's psychological benefits and spiritual benefits.
We have an email from Melinda, who is emailing us from New Hampton. She says, Kathleen Norris has probably been the most influential writer in my life. Yesterday, I was at church early with her acedia book with me. It was just what I needed. I often recall her words in the Quotidian Mysteries about shoveling snow out to the clothesline just to have the pleasure of outdoor dried sheets.
Yes. I when I was in South Dakota, I would sometimes work up the nerve to put on gloves and hang out clothes in the winter because they freeze dry on the line sometimes, but they still have that wonderful summery smell of clothes that have been dried outside. So it's just, I'm weird. I can't help it.
There was something therapeutic about hanging clothes out to dry.
It's a little hard when it's below like 20,
yeah,
20
well,
degrees. You have to really be dedicated or crazy.
Kathleen Norris is with us today on Talk of Iowa, A Marriage, Monks, and a Writer's Life, Acedia, and Me. Much of the book, we haven't even gotten to the book, the long section about your life with David Dwyer, your husband who died in 2003. You write that David had not hidden from me the formative details of his life, his college education interrupted first by a mental breakdown, then by grave illness, his mother's early death, but there was much that he had kept from me and from himself, a depth of dread and anguish he had held bottled up for years. And for years, he was faced with medical conditions and problems, and the last few years, I'm sure, were extraordinarily trying for you as you spent many, many days in hospital rooms in Bismarck, North Dakota, with him.
And in Honolulu, because that's where he passed away. Yeah.
Right. You know, one thing I was going to ask you about him, you say he was a terrible procrastinator. And I was thinking, here's a guy that was extraordinarily bright. He produced a couple of books of excellent poetry. But yet, why did he procrastinate so much?
He was a world-class procrastinator. And what I used to assume was that he stayed in the womb almost 10 months, and the doctors finally had to do a C-section to get him out. And I said, you know, that kind of made sense to me, that he just was pretty comfortable in there and didn't see any reason to get disturbed. And he was just like that. And I'm just the opposite. I'm pretty goal-oriented and stuff. So, you know, between the two of us, it's like a lot of marriages. We kind of balanced each other out and sometimes drove each other a little crazy. But once we realized, okay, he's that way, I'm this way, it worked out.
What was it like living in Lemon, South Dakota for all that time? What was, first of all, this is a town of, what, 1,000 or fewer?
About 1,400 people now. It was many more than that. It's like one of those typical Western Plains towns. It sort of has a slow attrition rate. I knew the place from my childhood summers. David was a New Yorker. He'd been up in the Adirondacks a lot as a child, but mainly New York City and the suburbs. And we just took it on a lark. You know, we thought, okay, we were kind of tired of New York City. We were living in Manhattan, and we come out to this little town where I think one of the buildings we're in Manhattan had more people than this town did. But David fell in love with the landscape, and I knew and loved the landscape. It's rolling, and it's a really, to us, it was a beautiful landscape. A lot of people can't see the beauty there. They think there's nothing there. We got very affectionate about small town life. I mean, we could go back to, we had friends in Chicago, friends in New York we would go visit, and we still enjoyed cities. But there's something about a small town where you know people. And even now when I'm in Honolulu, I mean, I go to the grocery store and I don't know the entire soap opera of people's lives, like the checkout clerk. I don't know anything. I don't, like in Lemon, South Dakota, I would know, you know, why so-and-so stopped wearing her platinum blonde wig and gave up on men, and I'd know the whole incredible story. I go into an urban supermarket, and I don't know. I mean, I can say hello and be nice, and I see the same checkout clerks, but I don't know the story of their lives, and they don't know the story of mine, and it feels like we're cheating ourselves. It's kind of, you know, having been an urban person and a small-town person, I'm finding it difficult to sort of readjust.
You write, like faith, marriage is a mystery. This is in chapter 5. The person you're committed to spending your life with is known and yet unknown, at the same time remarkably intimate and necessarily other.
That's marriage.
Yeah. I bet you two had some amazing conversations over the years.
We did. We were each other. We never really collaborated on anything, but I was his first reader and he was my first reader. And it all worked out, and I thought that, you know, part of this whole book had to be about the marriage, and it had to be about our lives as writers and kind of how that all worked in the course of our, you know, him suffering from depression, myself sometimes from acedia. But somehow it did work out, and the marriage worked.
But, you know, Kathleen, you when you had your periods of acedia, you had your strong faith in the Christian religion, and that worked for you much of the
time.
Well,
I really left the religion for about 20 years. So it was only around the time I was discovering the word acedia, I was gradually making my way back. But I wouldn't say I had a real strong faith or I was very certain of anything. I mean, I knew that it had been the religion of my childhood, and I was starting to see that it could be my religion as an adult. That's why I wrote Amazing Grace, when I wrote about all the words of Christianity that drove me crazy. And then when I started coming back to church, there were real barriers, and I sort of wrote that book to sort of help bring the barriers down. But I did. I remember after my husband died, when he was very, very ill, and I was doing, you know, really a lot of caregiving in the last 5 years of his life, and someone said, "Have you lost your faith in God?" And I said, "Of course not." And what it was very, until she asked me that question, I hadn't occurred to me what was happening was that I knew I had absolute faith in God's presence. I just couldn't feel it in my own life. But I knew it was somehow it was present in the world or for other people, and that was okay. That was kind of the value of community, that even if I wasn't feeling it, other people were, and that eventually I would feel it again too, but it wasn't a loss of faith at all.
And David was raised a Catholic, but he didn't have that strong connection with his
No, but his I never worried about his spiritual life, because that's his spiritual life was really centered in his just a really being a really good human being, and also a real gentle soul. He had a lot of compassion, and a lot of his spiritual life really showed up in the poetry, in the work. And I think for myself, I mean, I think for a lot of artists, your art form, poetry or writing or art, sculpture, whatever, can substitute for religion. It really is your spiritual life, and it works pretty well for a lot of people. It stopped working for me, and that's why I ended up making my way back to church.
Chapter 7, you quote the criminologist S. Giora Shoham, saying that acedia is more than a breakdown in meaningful interaction among human beings. It is a thorough disengagement. Later in Chapter 7, you say we have come to treat economic laws of supply and demand as though they were the laws of the universe.
Yeah, and I think that was another thing of the social aspects. Like when I grew up in an America that really didn't have homelessness. And I remember going to India once when I was in college and seeing all the homeless and seeing all the beggars and thinking, well, gee, you know, there's nothing like that in America. And at that time, there really wasn't. We had skid rows where alcoholics were living in flop houses. But that was about it. And how did we come to accept homelessness as just one of the facts of the universe, that this is just how things are? Because it isn't how things are, it's how we've made them. And, you know, seeing those sort of social disengagement that we've been allowed to happen to us over the last 50 years or so.
Let's go next to Roger, who's calling from Lisbon. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. Two things that occurred to me, I think, and I don't know who to attribute this to. I'm going to say Martin Marty, who came to Co a number of years ago, and he said, we don't believe our way into acting, we act our way into believing. And I think that's very powerful. And the second thing is that I think, well, I'm not a philosopher, I certainly think that existentialism is a powerful reality, that we somehow believe that we're supposed to believe the things that we're told, but fundamentally each of us has to sort out and come to terms with get a handle on the nature of our existence.
Okay.
Well, we lost him.
Thank you for that quote from Martin Marty. And I have to tell you that when I was first deciding I was going to write this book, I saw Martin Marty in Chicago at an event sponsored by the Christian Century, and he was so interested. We had a breakfast together, and he talked about all this. He ended up giving me one of his books, one of the very few books actually written on the subject of acedia, and he said, "You can use this now more than I can." And that was one of the things that really got me going with the book.
Roger, thanks for the call, 866-780-9100. Kathleen Norris, you quote the Psalms a lot in this book, and I'd sort of forgotten about the Psalms. I mean, but they are very meaningful for you. Many of them are pretty simple and short, but you repeat them a lot just to get yourself
They're
motivated.
Never really simple. I mean, I think I've started to think of the Psalms as a really bitchy friend who always tells you the truth, whether you want to hear it or not. And, you know, a lot of people forget about the Psalms. They're all poetry, of course. And if you hang out in a monastery for a day or two, you're going to be immersed in the Psalms because that's what they do at their prayer services. It's almost all Psalms. And of course, continuing the Jewish tradition of reciting the Psalms at morning and noon and evening. But for most Christians, you might hear a little snippet on Sunday morning, but you don't get a sense of what's actually in that book, and it's disturbing. I mean, the Psalms really reflect every human emotion, even the ones we don't want to admit to, like desire for revenge, anger, even anger at God. It's all in there, and so I know Peter Gomes, in one of his books on the Bible, says when people come to him and say, I want to know the Bible, he says, he sends them to the Psalms. He said, just keep reading the Psalms until you find one that speaks to you directly at this moment in your life, because you will find one. And there's history there, there's prophecy, there's all sorts of elements. Really, it's like the Bible in microcosm. So it's a really powerful book, and I really am grateful to monastic communities for sort of reintroducing me to this powerful poetry.
There's 150 psalms, something
yes.
like that, right? Question, you quote a writer, Henri de Lubac, who says it is not sincerity, it is truth, which frees us because it transforms us, it tears us away from our inmost slavery. To seek sincerity above all things is perhaps at bottom not to want to be transformed. So what's wrong with sincerity?
Well, I think that often sincerity is an evasion of the truth. And I love that quote. Henri de Lubac was a really sort of prophetic French theologian, I think early 20th century. But I just love that quote, because if we're seeking sincerity above everything else, we think it matters. But I think often it is an evasion of what's real and what's true. It's not the whole picture. It might make us feel better, and I think that's why we do it. Sentimentality makes us feel better about ourselves. We might shed a few tears over somebody or something, but we're really being very evasive of what really matters.
Let's go to one more call. Craig is dialing in from Cedar Rapids. Craig, you're on the air. If you can make it quick.
Well, there is a difference between Christianity and all the other religions of the world. In Christianity, God seeks after man. In all the other religions of the world, man seeks after God. And in Christianity, the more you learn to give in to what he reveals to you, the more you get it. And it's obedience through faith. And you can literally rest in the Lord once you just start learning to walk in the Spirit and take Romans 12, 1 and 2 seriously in your life.
All right, Craig, thanks for that. We'll have Kathleen give about 30 seconds here, Kathleen.
Well, I think God seeks after man. I mean, but then we also have work to do. And I think reading the Psalms every day, thinking about our thoughts as they arise, because part of our human makeup is dealing with bad thoughts as well as good thoughts, and that's just part of who we are.
Well, the hour has gone very quickly. Thank you so very much for stopping by, Kathleen Norris. Her new book, Acedia and Me, A Marriage, Monks, and a Writer's Life. We've learned a new word and all of its ramifications. Very wonderful book.
And an ancient word, new and ancient.
You'll be speaking tonight at 7 at the Iowa City Public Library. We had technical assistance today from Jeff Schmidt. Our student producer today was Rosalind Sixby. Podcasting and on-demand audio, Talk of Iowa, available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music composed and performed by Dan Knight. I'm Dennis Rees. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. We'll be right back.